Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Washington Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. The Biden administration submitted its $849.8 billion defense budget request to Congress, even as the Hill has yet to properly pass an appropriations bill for 2024. Ukraine strikes deep in Russia as Vladimir Putin stuns the world by getting elected to another six-year term. New reporting says that if Donald Trump secures a second term, he'll withdraw America from NATO, withdraw U.S. troops from Japan and Korea, and let China have Taiwan. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer criticizes Israel's campaign in Gaza as eroding long-term global support for the Jewish state and labels Bibi Netanyahu an obstacle to peace. This as the Israeli leader has authorized the offensive against Rafah that Washington has called for restraint, entailing the forced movement of more than 1 million refugees in Jerusalem's campaign to eradicate Hamas leadership that is thought to have taken refuge in that southern city. Joining us today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, Michael Herson, President of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, former Pentagon Europe Chief Jim Townsend, now with the Center for a New American Security and a co-host of the Brussels Sprouts podcast, a must for anybody interested in the transatlantic alliance that continues to break news and give unprecedented analysis of what's going on both sides of the pond, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations, and he is a contributor to a number of august publications as well as The Hill. Michael, first, everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. I'm sorry I jumped there a little bit. Michael, obviously, the big news of the week is the Biden administration's submission to Congress of, I think it's a $1.8 trillion, $1.7 trillion budget request for FY25. This as the 24 appropriations still hang in the balance. We'll get to appropriations and the supplemental in a minute. But first, I want to go around the horn, given that the budget touches all of our beats, right? All of your areas of interest. They were tightly shaped by the budget deal the administration made with lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, at their demand. And authorization measures have pretty tightly, constrained where and on what the administration can spend its money. While I think the budget should be higher, people in hell want ice water too. It is what it is. And I think that the administration generally made some pretty thoughtful trade-offs to try to get us there. What did you make of it overall? And what are some of the political challenges to make it a reality?
So, look, you're right about the budget to the extent that you're talking about this fiscal year and FY25. But remember, the budget they sends over paints a 10-year picture, right? And the 10-year picture that the president is painting really just ignores fiscal reality and ignores the threats that we face globally right now. Over the next 10 years, the president projects that we will spend $86.6 trillion and collect about $70 trillion in revenue. So deficits will increase over $16 trillion under his projections. And they're actually worse than that because his projections are based on raising corporate taxes, raising individual taxes, raising Medicare taxes, raising taxes on the wealthiest taxpayers. Those things are not going to happen. Right. So the budget deficits are going to grow even higher, which will actually increase more pressure to cut defense spending. Right. I mean, what his projections show that he wants to spend 25% make government spending 25% of the economy. Right. And over the last 50 years, the average has been 21%. So instead of letting outlays fall, at the end of the COVID crisis, they're actually increasing. And this is coming at the expense of the of defense spending, because defense is about 3.1% of GDP in 25. Under the president's projections of the 10-year window, it falls to 2.4% of GDP, which is really contrary to his 1941 moment that he talked about during his State of the Union address. Now, look, you're right. His hands are tied by the numbers in 25 because of the Fiscal Responsibility Act. I think the Republicans share a big part of that blame. But look, again, the Navy wants to retire 10 ships and only buy six. So the Air Force wants to retire 250 aircraft. This greatly diminishes our ability to project power around the world. The Army is actually going to shrink by 10,000 troops. Again, not accepting the reality we're facing around the world, the threats that we face. Now, look, congressional reaction so far has been, I think fairly strong, but I think that they don't realize yet how much their hands are tied, because there is talk, one from Senator Wicker, about spending more money. His counterpart, Mike Rogers, says that the defense top line fails to keep pace with inflation and does not deal well with our adversaries overseas. Congressman Banks says you're going to hear defense hawks calling for stronger budgets in the case to come. I just don't see that as reality, not just in 25, because our hands are tied by the FRA. But remember, after the next election, we got to deal with the debt ceiling all over again in January, which, again, I think will continue to put more pressure on defense spending.
To quote the immortal Anthony Bourdain, right? People want a unicorn that craps rainbows too, right? That's not happening either. It's a little bit disingenuous for the lawmakers that participated in, sort of a broader budget control act than complaining about the defense spending not being high enough. Should the administration, let me ask you a cynical political mechanics question. Should the administration have asked for more money, asking for what it thought DOD needed rather than what lawmakers would approve, right? I mean, there are those who say that at least President Obama was right in at least always, despite the Budget Control Act, asking for how much he thought he needed and able to sort of negotiate up a little bit in the number, as opposed to coming in at a number that is the number, right? I mean, effectively.
Look, I think it's a great question. And I actually think that he should have. Right. Because, again, our fiscal problems are not because of defense spending, and they're not because of non-defense discretionary spending. They're because of mandatory spending, and they're because of revenue. And I think the president would have been wise to try and force the conversation into where it needs to go and show that he does care about national security, national defense, and force the Republicans to cut the defense budget that he sent over.
I think we're unrealistic about all of this. Okay. The revenue picture needs to be stronger, which means you have to increase taxes. You also have to reduce government spending and then change where you spend spending. But you're absolutely right, right? Mandatory spending is mandatory spending. It is taking an enormous toll on you. And this is the first year where servicing the national debt is actually bigger than the defense budget, something we've projected and discussed for a long time. Dove, I want to bring you into the discussion. I believe, this conversation, you could have been having this conversation 20 years ago when I remember there was a roundtable when you had just become comptroller and we were talking about some of these longer term trends. Dove, what's your sense? You've seen a budget or two in your years. What did you make of this? And I should point out, you wrote a great piece in The Hill that folks should check out. There's no predicting what the next defense budget will look like, which I think is very fair and appropriate. Go ahead, take it away.
Well, I tend to agree with what Mike said, with one major exception. He's much too uptight about 10 years. Truth of the matter is, once you get beyond the first or maybe the second year of a budget, it's all funny money. It doesn't mean anything. The other thing to bear in mind, and this is what I wrote about, is that the last year of an administration's budget, which in other words is a budget for the next administration, is rarely realistic. Most of the time, those budgets have been much higher than what people expected to actually spend. This year, it's the other way around. There's no increase in this budget. It's actually a real decline. The only question is how big it is the decline. Right now, inflation is higher than the Fed thought it would be at this point. If that keeps up, we're talking about a significant decline in the defense budget in real terms, maybe as much as $18 billion. So once there's a new administration, if it's Trump, who knows what it'll look like? He could want a bigger cut in the defense budget. And even if it's Biden, depending on what's going on in Europe, what's going on in Asia, what's going on in the Middle East, he may find that he has to ask for more money. Now, one other point, it's Congress that passed the Fiscal Responsibility Act. And if it wants to get around the act, it can do it. It's its own. It's right. Kind of like Social Security and Medicare. Everybody says, oh, it's mandatory. You can't touch it. You can't touch it for political reasons, not for legislative reasons. If Congress wanted to change something, it could, and it may well. There's also another way out, which is supplementals. I mean, even the current defense program assumes supplementals. For instance, the Army says it desperately needs that supplemental. Supplementals are a way of getting around your legislation without changing your legislation. So my bottom line on all of this is I don't believe a word of it. Now, there are some very bad signals, and maybe Patrick may want to talk about one of them. One submarine is not going to get you to the level where you can provide Australia with submarines. And the previous Prime Minister of Australia, Turnbull, has already said that AUKUS is not real because they're not going to get the submarines they're supposed to get. Now, there are other elements of AUKUS, and those are real. But the point is, the signal to Australia is not exactly a good one. Cutting back.
Well, if I just may interject, though, right, the Navy leaders, as well as Mike McCord, explained, we already have 12 submarines on order. It's going to be years before we can get any of those delivered. And so we're deciding to only order one this year so that the $5 billion that we're investing in the submarine industrial base will allow us to start getting those submarines for U.S. needs as well as the Australian submarines faster. So that was one of the things where everybody knows what a big sub fan I am. And we were the first ones to report that there was only going to be one in the budget.
Look, Vago, I have the greatest respect for Mike McCord. He's really a terrific professional. But the fact of the matter is that if you're going to want to get to 2 1/3 submarines on a yearly basis, you got to start building now. It's as simple as that. Everybody knows the numbers. And again, even if you want to use the tortuous logic that the administration is using, that's not a great signal to Australia when its own former prime minister is coming out and saying it's nonsense. So there's a problem there, and maybe Patrick will disagree with me. I don't know.
He's not the biggest fan of American nuclear submarines. I should also put that out, having had that conversation with him as well. More broadly, Dove, is there anything else in the budget that you wanted to sort of briefly weigh in on before we go to Patrick and to Jim?
Well, again, I think the cuts that are being made are the worst signal possible to Xi and Putin. I mean, Putin just looks at all of this and he goes, hey, they're backing away. Because if you add that to all that's going on currently with the Ukraine supplemental, he must be feeling pretty good, not just because he's been reelected again.
I definitely will agree with you on the supplemental part and the message that it sends. Jim, you're now in sunny Paris where you are teaching. Again, what a way to spend the spring. The European Defense Initiative has now almost $4 billion in it, I think $3.9 billion. Just talk to us broadly about the budget. What did you like? What did you not like? And whether or not the EDI is enough money to continue to reinforce America's presence. And indeed, America's presence is the backbone of NATO.
Well, you know, I agree with Dove and with Michael. I wonder what this, I agree about the signals being sent to Putin and to Xi and to the European allies who are scrapping with themselves about increasing their defense budgets. And the UK, you know, there's quite a battle going on and between France and Germany. And here the US comes in with a budget like this, not showing leadership, I guess. I mean, I'm puzzled by this. And I'm puzzled by the people who put this together in OSD policy. I mean, you know, there's comptroller and as Dove tells us every time we talk, we get the idea of what it's like to be a comptroller and dealing with fiscal realities and dealing with the numbers and dealing with the process and the mechanisms. But I'm thinking about the policy of it. You know, the comptroller is told by the policy people, you know, I mean, the SecDef and his crew, okay, you know, this is kind of where we want the budget to go, et cetera. I mean, it's not quite that simple, but this is a reflection of thinking on the NSC staff and OMB and the higher reaches of OSD. And I'm just wondering on a political policy side, I'm puzzled why they're doing this. Kath Hicks, and who is very much involved in this, are they really showing what they think in terms of the threat? Are they really showing that, hey, you know, it's all about China, it's not about Russia? And their thinking on and their views on this is being expressed in the numbers. You know, they say in the Pentagon, the numbers talk and bullshit walks. And so these numbers are talking, and what they're talking about is puzzles me, because you would think that we don't really see this situation that we're in terms of the Russian threat and how flat-footed we are in a lot of ways, that they don't seem to be seeing that as a problem. I'm just puzzled by it, and I just don't know what to think of the people themselves, the political appointees who have guided the budget to go in this direction.
Patrick, the Pacific Defense Initiative now has nearly $10 billion, $9.9 billion. Give us your sense on whether or not you agree with others on the roundtable that this budget is not as good as it could be, especially from an Indo-Pacific standpoint.
Well, the administration has made the case consistently that China is the pacing threat. This budget does not show that China is the pacing threat. And yet, testimony after testimony this week alone, NORTHCOM, SOUTHCOM, CIA director, ODNI, China, 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 and yet the money is not there, whether it's also money for Ukraine war, by the way, and it doesn't help to have a former president at the country club saying we'll give not a penny to Ukraine if he's elected. But this budget looks like we are a low-functioning superpower and not really ready for the competition. I would just invite listeners to go and just watch SOUTHCOM and NORTHCOM's testimony this week about the threat that is at the door. It's right there. And the fact that China will be flying into our air defense identification zones in the coming months, in all likelihood, joining Russia, suggests that we really do have a big threat. Whether the budget can ever handle this, we can't do it alone. And that's the other disconnect. The disconnect is not just between the intelligence briefings and the budget, but also between our protectionist electoral politics. You think about U.S. Steel, when we're going to need Japan, for instance, to be repairing our ships so we can keep a forward posture. Or the message, and I agree with Dove 100% on AUKUS, this is the wrong message to send to the Australians. When Turnbull is not a lightweight. He is a serious former prime minister. I have great respect for him. But he's wrong on this issue, and he is leading, unfortunately, an ingrowing chorus inside Australia that suddenly we are not doing the burden sharing on defense. Oh, really? We're not sharing high technology. Oh, really? We're not, putting a target on our backs. We are also sharing sovereignty loss here with our allies by joining forces with them, because unless we join together, we cannot stand up to even the troubled Chinese economy, because Xi Jinping is doubling down on defense modernization. And to read the lessons out of his speeches this last week in terms of the two sessions, he's putting everything on defense technology, on military-civil fusion, and pushing the state security apparatus to be more strategic. They're penetrating our system. They're burrowed in our computers, according to other testimony this past week. So, the threat is real and big. We can't solve it with one budget, but this budget does not look serious to me. If I'm in Beijing, if I'm in Moscow, if I'm in Pyongyang, I'm not worried about this budget.
But I will point out, right, a lot of the rearmament stuff that we're looking for is all in the supplemental part of the budget, whether in the industrialization of it and whether the actual buying of capabilities, right? I mean, the rearming is in this supplemental, which is what I think, and to Dove's point, makes up for it not being in the base budget, right? I mean, they were looking at it as Congress is going to pass this so we can put it in there. We can argue that that's, bad planning. My point would be, you have so underinvested for such a long period of time and optimized everything for efficiency. Now you're just being caught out. And the only way to solve this, I'm not even sure if we said, okay, we're going to do a $2 trillion for the next 3 years in order to try to fix this. I'm not even sure the system could absorb it. They're running out of space to put nuclear submarine components, I was told, but by somebody who wants more submarines built. By the way, I'm one of the biggest submarine proponents in Washington. I completely agree with that. But I mean, it's to me, it's the challenge of you're trying to address this with a budget cap, and you don't even have a regular order. So I sort of appreciate, I'm looking at it at least that we did put some thoughtful things into the PDI and the EDI in order to be able to at least somewhat move the ball forward. Michael, speaking of dysfunction, here we are 5 months into a continuing resolution. The 25 budget request is going to Congress before Congress even rules on what 24 appropriations are going to look like. And then there is the increasing crap show that is the supplemental debate. Walk us through where we are on this. and what shape and contour this is all going to take, because you know we're on a CR. I guess the Pentagon's is March 26th, I think, was when it expires. Walk us through where we are on those discussions, broadly on appropriations, but also on the supplemental.
Okay, well, they're both kind of a mess, and Pentagon expires on March 22nd, which is when the next six bills expire. But it's really 1 week shy of 6 months under a CR, not five. I mean, half the year we would have spent, which is just atrocious, and again shows that we're just not taking our national security seriously. Last week I mentioned with the remaining six bills that there was one that was problematic, and it was the Homeland Security bill. And I'll get to that in a second. Now, there's only one that's really not problematic. That's the defense bill. That one's done. It's ready to go. The other five all have problems. There's one big problem that's now emerged on the state and foreign operations bill. I had heard about this problem 2 weeks ago, and I just assumed that it would be resolved by now, and it's not. That is the fight over funding for the United Nations Relief Works Agency, or UNRWA. Right. The U.S. government had suspended funding last month for UNRWA after it was made clear that employees of UNRWA actively participated in the October 7th attacks.
About a dozen of the 22,000 employees were in question.
Doesn't matter, right? I mean, I don't want to make excuses for them. These people work for UNRWA, and the 22 that we know of, right? So, and it's important to note that the bipartisan package that passed the Senate, the supplemental, last month included language barring funding for UNRWA, and it called on the State Department and USAID to set up procedures to make sure that Hamas and other terrorist and extremist entities in Gaza don't get any U.S. funds. Now, House Republicans want to keep this restriction in place as part of the FY24 State and Foreign Operations Bill. House and Senate Democrats don't want to handcuff the UN agency that's charged with providing relief for the Palestinians. This is now becoming a line in the sand for both sides, which really could end up derailing that bill. Now, Homeland Security is even a larger problem than it was last week. Senator Collins, who's a senior Republican on the Appropriations Committee, told her colleagues yesterday she doesn't see a path for a bipartisan deal on the 24 Homeland Security funding bill. And apparently a year-long CR for the Homeland Security Department is already being drafted. And this would be several billion dollars less than they'd gotten previously under a CR. But it's the only way to avoid a partial government shutdown unless they pass a short-term CR to continue negotiations on Homeland. Now they're clashing over border patrol funding, how much to spend on detention facilities, shelter for undocumented immigrants, and a host of other issues. So and these bills, in order to comply with the 72-hour rule in the House, have to be filed this weekend. They give the House time to vote on it and then send it over to the Senate and get it over to the President's for signature. So we are really up against the wire here. If there is a CR for Homeland, and if it's a year-long CR, I would assume, based on my conversations, that they would put a fix in there for the across-the-board 1% cut, which is included in the FRA. Now, the supplemental continues also to be a mess. Now, I mentioned previously that I still believe that the Senate bill is still the only game in town, even though there's lots of other proposals out there. Now, Congressman McGovern, who's a senior Democrat on the House Rules Committee, has a discharge petition to move the Senate package. That discharge petition was filed on February 15th. So given the 30 days, it must wait until it's ripe. That means it won't be ready until May 15th. Now, that's 30 legislative days, not calendar days, right? So this will take a long time. Right now, 177 Democratic signatures are on that discharge petition. Once they get to 218, they need an additional 7 legislative days to pass before it can be brought to the floor. They're not going to get to 218 unless they get Republican signatures, and they're going to need a bunch because they're not going to get all the Democrats on that. Now, we have this centrist plan, which we talked about before, being pushed by Congressman Fitzpatrick and Congressman Golden, which will just fund military aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. It includes some border security. That discharge petition would ripen even later because it was filed later. That only has 14 signatures on it. Chairman McCaul, who chairs the Foreign Affairs Committee, is also drafting a plan. And now, as you know, we have former President Trump in the background saying that we should make any Ukraine aid a loan, which is now resonating with Speaker Johnson, saying that he might be able to do something like that. Now, look, McConnell earlier this week continued to beat the drum. He reiterated that Johnson needs to allow a vote on the Ukraine bill. allow a vote so that the House can speak. He said the only way to get relief to Ukrainians and Israelis quickly is for the House to figure out how to pass the Senate bill. This is what I've been saying. I agree 100%. McConnell said, we don't have time for this. We've got a bill that got 70 votes in the Senate. Give the members of the House a chance to vote. That's the only solution. Johnson yesterday says that he expects to take up a future foreign aid package very soon. And it would be a standalone bill and maybe two separate bills. It would not be attached to the funding package next week. And, you know, he would have to be done on suspension because they can't get anything through the Rules Committee. So they would need Democratic votes to get this passed. So they're going to have to negotiate with Democrats if they're going to go down this path. And they would probably break it up into two different bills, one for Ukraine, one for Israel, and include it as the Ukraine aid as a loan or a lend-lease program. He's also talking about including something similar to the Repo for Ukrainians Act, which was sponsored by Congressman McCaul, which would authorize the confiscation of Russian assets to deposit the proceeds into a Ukrainian support fund. Now, to complicate things even further, and I know we'll talk about this some more.
Right? But wait, there's
I know,
more.
There's more, right? Wait, there's more.
The good news is the Pentagon did find $300 million in aid that it was able to send Ukraine. So there is a little bit of a silver lining there.
But $300 million is a drop in the bucket, right?
And that's a really –
I'm glad you mentioned that because it's a really good point because I was talking about this with a very senior member of the Armed Services Committee earlier this week because the Pentagon still has about $4.4 billion in drawdown authority for Ukraine. They are not exercising that, right? Because the supplemental hasn't passed. We have a huge gaping hole in replenishing our own missiles and munitions. So we're afraid to dip any deeper into it to send for Ukraine because we're putting ourselves in a very precarious position. Because of the failure to pass this bill, we are putting ourselves in a hole and preventing us from using the remaining drawdown authority. Now, the other complicating matter on this is what Senator Schumer did yesterday, right? I mean, he took the Senate floor and he delivered this sharp criticism of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, condemning Netanyahu, saying he's lost his way amid Israel's battle with Hamas, saying that Netanyahu's coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel, and he believes that new elections are the only ways for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future. And he's also floating the idea of supporting some of the progressives' demands on conditions or restrictions on aid to Israel, which, you know, is an interesting dichotomy where they're opposing any restrictions on aid to UNRWA, but they would now support restrictions on aid to Israel. Now, look, I think some of the outrage in the House can be conceived as a little fake because they're the ones that are holding up Israel aid. They could easily pass the Senate bill, and the Senate bill doesn't have any of these restrictions in it. But I think the outrage in the Senate is real. I mean, McConnell immediately lambasted the speech yesterday, calling it grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about interference in our own democracy to call for Netanyahu's removal. And Senator Tillis said he wondered what it would have been like if the Knesset had called for new elections in the U.S. months after the 9/11 attack. But most importantly, Benny Gantz, who is Netanyahu's chief rival, said this was a mistake, that this should not have been done. And look, I have done, as you know, extensive work in the Middle East. This emboldens our enemies and Israelis' enemies. I'm sure that the social media platforms of Hamas, the Houthis, Hezbollah are lighting up to say, look, you see, you know, our tactics are working. Israel is positioned, the United States is weakening. We got to keep going. It just weakens us. And it just shows, I think, that our whole foreign policy is collapsing. Ukraine now can't count on us. Israel can't count on us. We can't supply our allies and partners with the weapon systems they need. Right. I mean, there are European NATO allies that are being told to take years to get them what they want. We still can't supply to Taiwan things we promised them years ago. Right. If Trump were to win, he's talking about not fulfilling our obligations under NATO. I mean, Jim Townsend raised an excellent point about what message this budget sends to the rest of the world. What actions do these send to the rest of the world that the United States cannot be counted on? And our European allies are going to look to South Korea and other places to get their weapons systems. But our non-NATO allies could look to China for these weapon systems, and it would increase their influence and their power and diminish ours. And not just for those weapon systems, but to show that we're an unreliable partner.
Completely agree with you on that, about the signals that this is more broadly sending. I think the issue, and I want to bring Dove in here to comment since you raised the Chuck Schumer question, The issue is how the campaign is being prosecuted and whether there are unnecessary civilian casualties. Nobody is debating Israel's right to respond to this, especially because of the atrocities of October 7. The question is, how do you prosecute a campaign that actually is successful, because there is no historical analog to this, without creating more terrorists and more strife for the future? And I just have to say, it's a little rich for Bibi Netanyahu, who's weighed in on four separate presidential campaigns to try to shape them, to be complaining about one lawmaker criticizing them. It wasn't the U.S. Congress that criticized them, so it's not a Knesset equivalent. It was a prominent member. Dove, let me just have you jump in here for a minute to discuss just, you know, your sense of all of this, and, you know, whether or not the majority leader broke decorum, and what's the right way ahead? Ultimately, what's the right way ahead? That's consistent and good, both for our allies and partners, whether it's Israel, Ukraine, or anybody else.
First of all, let me just point out that when Michael said that we're in a hole on the presidential drawdown authority, we're in a $10 billion hole. It's not a little one. And the $300 million was kind of sleight of hand, because they said, well, we got savings out of the contracts. Well, unless they got $300 million in savings, which means they had about $600 million in contracts, I don't know how that mathematics works. So let me just set that aside. On Schumer, first of all, I want to quote something that Mr. Netanyahu said some years back when he was about to address the Congress here. He's not I'm not just the prime minister of Israel, but I'm speaking as a representative of the entire Jewish people. Well, if he thinks he can represent the entire Jewish people, then Senator Schumer has every right to say, you ain't representing me. And at the time, by the way, there was an outcry on the part of the large segments of the American Jewish community that said, who are you to say you speak for us? So, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, kind of thing. As for the substance of what Schumer said, everybody seems to forget that he also said that Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, needs to go, that they need to have a very different kind of Palestinian Authority leadership. He did not come out against any kind of reduction in aid to Israel. He said that Israel needs a plan for the future, which everybody else is saying, and which Netanyahu refuses to come up with. He said that there needs to be a two-state solution, which Netanyahu refuses to agree with. And he didn't turn around and say the Israeli government should go. He just said that Netanyahu and some of the crazies should go, which is not an unreasonable argument that many, many people are saying around here. What really got people upset is that he said it, that the most senior Jewish politician, I guess, in American history, turned around and said something like that. I don't think I disagree with Mike on that. Yeah, sure. People will pull what he said out of context. People are always pulling what people say out of context. The fact of the matter is, Netanyahu, and I've been saying this for weeks, but of course I'm not Senate Majority Leader, Netanyahu is a drag on Israel. Gantz, by the way, had no option but to say what he said, because Israelis are actually furious. How dare the United States say anything other than support for us, even though we take American taxpayer money, even though we tell Americans what to do, even though our prime minister lectured an American president in the Oval Office. That doesn't matter. Well, guess what? It does matter.
Again, it's about the strategic long term for a nation that really does need international support. All right, let's shift gears. Jim. Ukraine is hanging on, as we've heard from CIA Director Bill Burns testified. He warned that without additional U.S. help, Ukraine is going to lose hard-fought ground to Russia, as Russia has really been arming up. French President Emmanuel Macron has convened German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Polish President Donald Tusk for a summit to map out the future of assistance for Ukraine. Obviously, everybody over there is concerned, and I think Macron's concerns are on multiple levels, right? I mean, you have to give the guy credit for leadership. He wants Europe to stand up and do more. He wants more spending across Europe. He's the one of the last leaders who continues to say, one of the important leaders who continues to say, Ukraine must win and Russia must lose. And he is also one of the folks who's hard line on not bending to Russian nuclear intimidation, which is the concern that Olaf Scholz backed down from sending Taurus cruise missiles to Ukraine because of that. And great reporting by the New York Times' David Sanger that the White House really, the magnitude with which in October 22, the White House feared Russian nuclear rhetoric and threats. And he discusses that in his book, New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. That's going to be out April 16. Give us your take on where the war stands. Give us your take on Europe's response to our budget. I think that you framed that a little bit. And the reality that the Russians know exactly what to plant and what chatter that we're picking up to drive the reactions. Still 2 years plus into this, we're still having this conversation as opposed to, and it's a very effective tool. Putin repeated it again on Monday. In an interview, where are we? Where are we going? And how do we need to be wrapping our minds around this?
Well, there's just a lot of wheel spinning in Europe. When when one says Europe, as we know, it's hardly a cohesive whole as a continent here. What Macron is saying, I think, is to my ears at least, a lot of important good things. At least he's getting really serious. He has made a big move from saying earlier last year, let's not humiliate Putin. Well, that was when the Ukrainian forces were doing well, and now he's got a fright in him, and he's truly trying to push nations to do more. But it's helping to prompt this reaction. The way he's doing it is helping to prompt this reaction from Scholz and other countries that are causing Putin to see a recoil in Europe. That doesn't surprise him. I keep thinking for Putin, he's toying with everyone in a lot of ways. And you're kind of making this point. He says things at the right time. He says it in the right way. And he sits back and he watches the reaction. It's like Trump. He will throw things out as well, bombastic things at these various rallies that he has. And he sits back and he loves to watch the Democratic reaction, everyone running around with their hair on fire. And he loves to see that. And Putin does the same thing with the Europeans, and they're rising to the bait. It's not that Europe is being the feckless, freeloading European allies who are taking advantage in the United States that we used to complain about 20 years ago, 10 years ago. We are seeing these nations grappling with trying to do something, and they're doing it in different ways. Some are not doing anything. As you go further south on the continent or further east on the continent, you're not seeing what you're seeing within the Balts or with Poland, with France now. But even with France, you're not seeing a lot of the results in terms of money or in terms of equipment. Someone once said that this was they're all hat and no cattle in a way.
Although the French maintain, I don't want a lawyer for Paris on this, but they maintain that actually, after initially being very clear about what they were doing, they've completely changed their mindset. And I did speak to a friend last week about that. There's a lot more stuff going and a lot more help going. It's just going quietly as opposed to telegraphing it to the whole world. Look at me and what I'm doing for what it's worth.
Well, yeah. And I hope it, in fact, that is the case, but I think what's important is that Macron is saying these things again, but he's saying it in a way and in a place that causes the reaction from his European colleagues. So his heart is in the right place, I think, but his vocal cords are taking us in another direction in terms of provoking recoil coming out of European capitals. And then Putin must just love it. He's toying with us like a cat toying with a mouse.
Really quickly, because I want to open this conversation up as well as to Patrick and get Dove's sense on it. In his new book, Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War, CNN's Jim Sciutto, another terrific reporter, details Donald Trump's second term agenda that'll include effectively withdrawing America from NATO, withdrawing American troops from Japan and Korea, and effectively leaving Taiwan to China. None of this is new. We've been discussing it, but he puts it really into stark context that these were agenda items the last time around. These continue to be agenda items. And unlike the last time where there'll be a Jim Mattis in between or a Mark Esper, right? Institutionalists and those who slow rolled backing troops out of Europe, right? I mean, Congress may have passed legislation. An American president can still gut NATO by just not participating, by withdrawing troops that requires no congressional authorization, particularly to do. You know, what signal is this ultimately sending, especially given that, that Trump is still ahead in national polling? And many people think he's going to win. And it, because GOP and independent vote, you know, now that he's the presumptive candidate, GOP leaders and voters are falling in line. Not too much of a hue and cry about what's happening at the RNC. Maybe, Michael, you want to talk about that a little bit later. And independents are going, yeah, I guess between the two of them, I'm going to go with Trump. He's more vigorous.
Well, I think overseas, particularly what Trump is saying, you know, is misunderstood in a lot of ways, not necessarily by the elites in the capitals, but I think there's a feeling over here that Trump has won or that Trump will certainly win. You know, there's not a nuanced feel that we might have in Washington watching the scene or, you know, but there seems to be this drumbeat that comes out of the United States and hits, I'll just talk about European ears now, that kind of gives them the impression, well, it's all over and Trump's coming. Right. And without the understanding that the American voter can surprise you. I was talking to someone a few days ago and said, you know, how many times have we had elections and the doomsayers at the very up to the last day have us heading into the pit? And the next day, the American voter surprised everyone. And they didn't exactly go in the direction the polls and the pundits said it was going to go in. And so, you know, that kind of nuance is lost over here. There's just a feeling that this is inevitable, it's happening, and Trump's going to win. And it's not, I don't think they have the understanding, the more nuanced feel that, well, we're in the early days and this is rhetoric, right, and we'll see what happens. But this could actually not look the way it looks today when the voting is done.
Patrick, your sense on how all of this is received, and whether, you know, I mean, it'll be the will of the people, right? I mean, if Americans elect Donald J. Trump for a second term, they will have made that decision and he will have his priorities, right? It's not necessarily illegitimate to say, hey, you know, Taiwan is the tip of the Sharpie and China's the resolution desk. They can't defend themselves anyway, and it's not worth it for us really to help them. It's not really ultimately in our interest. That is leadership, whether you may agree with it or not, in the new rules-based post-World War II order. What's your sense on this? What are folks telling you?
Well, I agree with Jim, both on our domestic politics can be surprising. Of course, you could cut that both ways. Ask President Hillary Clinton about surprise. But he's right. I think the voters may well deny Trump a second term. That's despite the fact that throughout Asia, I keep hearing nothing but the expectation that Trump might be coming back or is coming back. And they do gloss over the details that there has to be an election in November, and we'll see. Indeed, if I can go back to that U.S. Steel question that is beckoning about whether Japan should be able to buy U.S. steel, and President Biden this week weighing out against it. That's clearly a political calculus on the part of the White House. This is a campaign decision that we can't afford to lose votes in Pennsylvania or nationally by losing this emblem of American prowess that is embedded in U.S. steel, even though U.S. steel is actually only the second largest steel manufacturer now in the United States. And Japan happens to be one of our very closest allies. So it's very different from the strategy of small yard high fence that we've articulated in the White House on how to protect truly important technology like semiconductor chips from getting into Chinese weapon systems. That's a very different thing that we do need to be focused on, whereas we can afford some flexibility when it comes to even important manufacturing sectors like steel that has some purchased by friendly allies, even while we retain the majority of what we produce. The question about strategy here in Trump is overplayed by Jem Sciutto without having read his book, and I look forward to reading it. He is a good reporter, in the sense that I don't believe Trump has a strategy. I believe much more the Jim Mann thesis that he put out in the LA Times this week about you deal with bombast, you know, you sell it, and then you personalize it, and then you make deals and you sell those deals. You overhype and you under-deliver. So I don't think we know what Trump would actually do in a second term on some of these issues. We do know his approach. I mean, he would try to extort our allies for more, and some of that extortion, we can all agree, might be useful and good, and partners and allies do need to do more. But there's a matter of how you treat your partners versus how you treat your adversaries, and that's where the distinction is lost on Trump. They're all adversaries for him, except sometimes our adversaries seem to be his friends. And that's right. That's where I draw the line on Trump. I think finally on Trump, we have to be careful. My friend Harry Harris, former PACOM commander, as he was then called, and former ambassador to South Korea, great American, wrote in Nikkei Asia this week that he didn't think there'd be any significant difference in Asia policy. But I beg to differ with my friend Harry. I think that the loss of trust from allies and partners is already being felt and would be deeply felt if Trump returned to power. And that is a fundamental difference. So, it's better to have the continuity and predictability of even an 81-year-old president than it is to have somebody who might seem more vigorous and looks like he's protecting our interests, but in fact seems to be flip-flopping on issues from TikTok to other policies that he might switch on as well.
I believe you have to take him at his word. For all of his tendencies, these outbursts are a true window into what he is thinking, and you should take them at face value. There's, showmanship, certainly. A lot of it is nonsensical gobbledygook, right? I mean, if you watch a full rally, right, we look at the energetic clips, like the full rally is troubling in some respects. Michael, I think you've made that point before. There isn't really a filter, and maybe you should welcome that because it gives you kind of a true sense on where he's going. Dove, you've got an ad, and we'll go back to Patrick in a minute because I want to get his take on the region as well as India.
Well, I think that Patrick's closer to the reality, in the sense that we don't really know what Trump will do. And in fact, what may happen to be of more consequence are the kinds of people he names to implement whatever mad idea comes through his head. If they're people who are like Jim Mattis, who can essentially slow roll him, that's one thing. If he comes up with a Mike Flynn, for example, then we really have something to worry about. We don't know who will get elected, but again, as we heard from Jim and Patrick, and as I'm hearing from every foreigner I speak to, they are terrified. They're already worried. They think we're already isolationist. And so every time Trump says anything or a reporter like Jim Sciutto writes what he writes, they jump all over that, and it just reinforces this negative impression of where the United States is headed. That, I think, is the real danger, whether Trump's elected or not. Again, even if he is, I think one has to watch to see who exactly it is he's going to appoint. And finally, I know Trump would like to be president for life, but there is a constitution that he's got to deal with. And unless he can manage to change that after a year or so, he's going to be seen as a lame duck, and you may see a Congress that finally asserts itself. Again, who knows?
In the last election, Dove, a remarkably large percentage of Republicans and certainly Trump supporters wanted his term extended 4 years and felt it would be legitimate without an election. So I would argue that's very problematic in the United States, where every 2 years or every 4 years or every six, we get to get rid of somebody who we think isn't suited to do the job, whatever party they're in. Patrick, if you'll just be patient for 1 second, I want to bring Michael in because TikTok was a big deal, because I wanted to get your reaction to this and your sense on it. But Dove, Michael, tell us about what that sort of broadly means as it heads, you know, goes from the House to the Senate, and it passed overwhelmingly with a bipartisan vote in the House, which was welcome.
Well, this is relevant to what Patrick Cronin just said, right? Where he said that Trump doesn't have a strategy. And I read Jim Sciutto's last book, Shadow War, which makes it clear that China and Russia clearly do have a strategy. And part of China's strategy is TikTok, right? Because it does influence people here, especially our younger generation, and causes discontent and can help influence elections here as well. So finally, I think the House recognized this threat, moved very quickly on this legislation, and passed it earlier this week. And the legislation would force ByteDance to divest its stake in TikTok within 180 days, or the social media app would be banned in the United States. And the vote was overwhelming. 352 members of the House voted in favor of this. You know, striking for the people who voted against it, you had people like, you know, Ocasio-Cortez, Marjorie Taylor Greene. But then you had Congressman Jim Hines, who's the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, voted against it, despite the fact that Mike Turner supported it. And in the Senate, Senator Warner and Senator Rubio, who are the ranking and chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, support the bill. The bill faces uncertain future in the Senate, but the White House not only said that they would sign the bill, but now the White House later this week came out encouraging the bill, encouraging the Senate to quickly take it up. I think what's been fascinating here, too, and again, I think reinforces what Patrick Cronin said about Trump not having a strategy. Remember, when Trump was president, he signed an executive order to ban TikTok unless it was acquired by an American company, alleging that the Chinese government was using this to surveil Americans, right? Now, the order never went into effect because after it was challenged in federal court. But he completely reversed his position now after meeting with a GOP mega donor, Jeff Yass, who's a major investor in ByteDance, which is TikTok's parent company. So not only has Trump reversed course, but Yass is a huge donor to Club for Growth. Club for Growth is paying Kellyanne Conway now to lobby against the bill in the House and Senate. And Vivek Ramaswamy, who once called TikTok a digital fentanyl, also reversed his position after Yass contributed an enormous amount to his political action committee. So it's showing that there's really this group of the Trump part of the party really has no core beliefs whatsoever, and you know, changes with the winds and will follow whatever Trump's whim at the time is going to be. But I am hopeful that this bill will be picked up by the Senate, especially if the White House continues to push it. But it really remains to be seen. And part of the problem that the Senate does have a lot of other things to deal with, and eventually the Senate will be delayed once the articles of impeachment are sent over by Mayorkas, because the Senate will have to take those up right away. So that will also delay them as well.
We're almost at time, and we've got a lot to discuss. So we're going to go into a little bit of a lightning round, and I apologize for that. Look, I mean, it is also going to be very, very interesting. We've never had a president of the United States run with, I think, so much debt, with so many legal obligations, right? So many penalties to pay, and whether or not that compromises somebody at some level. Because he's going to have to go to people to get money. And what are the asks when you're asking for that kind of money, whether to repay New York State or, you know, people who he's allegedly defamed and what have you is a legitimate question, because unfortunately in this town, people are for it until they're against it, until people take money and shove it in your pocket. and then all of a sudden it's like, wow, they changed their opinion. It was just a good lunch. It was just over a good lunch. Patrick, really quick. So most important events in the region and India's development of an intercontinental ballistic missile capability that will hit anywhere in China with multiple independent reentry vehicles, right? Which is a first for the Indians, and a quantum leap in capability, right? That's first rung. And China's obviously response to, right, all of, you know, TikTok and, you know, some of the messaging that it's putting out.
Well, let me begin there, because they're, of course, on a campaign saying we are suppressing TikTok. We are robber We have a robber mentality by trying to steal their special technology, when in fact China would never allow and doesn't allow Facebook or Google or anything like this in China. They would never allow this. This is a national security issue, and I think that the co-chairs of the committee, you know, that spearheaded this, Gallagher and Krishnamurthy, have made it very clear. They've been extremely articulate on this matter. That's why I think the House passed it so fast and so decisively. It's now up to the Senate to act. Clearly, China doesn't like this, and they may well block the sale, and they may use that in part as extortion on the election. So this is their indirect election meddling. They're trying to say, ordinary people in America, it's the government officials that are hurting you. So if you know, if Biden is blamed for that, and meanwhile Trump looks like, oh no, he would support TikTok surviving, even while Steve Mnuchin is trying to put together a group to buy it, I think you know, this is politics, and this is a real. But at the end of the day, this is a national security threat, as Michael was saying. You know, this is right. The influence operations, writ large. And the Chinese, you know, are now making a play about the leak about the Trump administration having done a social media covert operation against China in the last administration. And the point here would be China is going into the deep end, doing swan dives, you know, of the swimming pool of influence operations. The United States has barely dipped its toe in the idea of influence operations on China. So there's really no comparison between the level of effort or scale of what's going on. Other news that's going on in the region, let me start with the fact that Russia, Iran, and China this weekend are beginning Maritime Security Belt 2024, a naval air drill in the Gulf of Oman and Arabian Sea. It reminds you that even though they're playing a very quiet role over what's happening in the Middle East, their presence is noted, and they're trying to build up that capacity. I would not give away our alliances. Our alliances are so strong and capable that we need to make sure we preserve them and keep promoting them. But nonetheless, this is a sign that this Cold War 2.0 is leading to shifts in the balance of military power and operations as well. It's one thing that North Korea is watching, and why a lot of people are convinced, officials have testified again this past week, that there is a strategic shift underway in North Korea. And it's part because North Korea is also thinking, revisionist alliance, you know, this is the time we have to act together and push back on borders, push back on the Western influence. Elsewhere, criticism of the Philippines for trying to stand up to China over the South China Sea, again, emerged leaked transcripts of a negotiation between China and the Philippines last year with the Marcos government, where the Marcos government clearly was not going to accept accessions to the sovereignty of Philippine seas and territory, which is what the Chinese were demanding in exchange for allowing some low-level resupply of Second Thomas Shoal, low-level fishing rights into Scarborough Shoal. And Marcos, to his credit, has stood up to this. And the Chinese have said, wait, we had a gentleman's agreement with Duterte. Well, and Marcos is making hay with this. We just right. had Admiral Aquilino in the Philippines. We have air cushion vehicles and craft in the region now, which is well placed, because if you think about resupply effort at Second Thomas Shoal, it's so low draft, you need something like an air cushion vehicle, a hovercraft. And so it's not only good for responding to the natural crises that will happen in the region, but also potentially to a China-led crisis. Secretary Raimondo, Commerce Secretary, led successful trade delegations to both the Philippines and Thailand this week. I think that's important only to note that America seems to have its act together to some extent in terms of trying to package our economic and our military weight. And then finally, you know, let's go to the Agni 5 missile, you know, the missile named for the god of fire. You know, it's about time that India created a capability that can actually reach northern China. You know, but at 3,100 mile range, that's still one half or one third of the range of some of the Chinese missiles that they've been building up. China's doubled the number of launch brigades, missile launch brigades in the last 15 years. They're doubling the number of nuclear warheads in the next 5 years. And so India is finally catching up. And even the Chinese had to notice this. They derisively said, oh, well, this is not, it doesn't amount to a threat because it's so far behind our capabilities. But the fact that they even acknowledge that suggests that they are taking note, and that India does have the attention of Beijing. and India's on the move here as Modi gets ready to get elected for a third term.
Indeed. Thanks very much for that roundup. Dove, we're at time, 30 seconds. The Rafah invasion, Israeli leaders say that they have gravely damaged Hamas's fighting ability. About a third of the casualties, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, obviously under Hamas leadership, 30 some odd thousand civilians killed, of which about a third are said to be fighters. Israeli leaders are saying that the bulk of the leadership has been cornered in Rafah, and so it's absolutely critical for us to go there and get them, even though there are criticisms of how Israel has been waging the campaign and unfortunately a high civilian death rate. I will point out, Hamas is deliberately putting civilians in the line of fire for a whole variety of reasons, obviously. What's your sense on this campaign? What does it mean? And does this become something that can be executed well and responsibly with minimal casualties? Or is this, as some fear, going to backfire even further on Israel?
Well, there are a bunch of complications here. First of all, as everyone knows now, we are building a kind of floating dock and have started sending ships to bring food into Gaza. The problem is, once you land the food and anything else, how do you get it to the people who need it?
Right.
Since Hamas is going to interfere with that. So there's a big question mark there. Another question mark is, what happens on the West Bank this month of Ramadan? Right now, about 10,000 Muslims were able to go up to the Temple Mount without problems. It was peaceful. Can that last the whole month? If it doesn't, which Hamas hopes it won't, then you've got a major flare-up on the West Bank as well, and how that plays out in Lebanon is a major question too. So there are issues with that. And obviously, the whole question of how you manage the Rafah operation, where are you going to move those people? They haven't right. said exactly where they'll go. And even if you identify where they'll go, how are you going to feed them? It brings you back to where I started. How do you get the support that they need to stay alive from, let's say, the coast inland to wherever they are? So there are a host of questions still surrounding all of this. And then there are some major internal problems inside Israel. There has to be a new law dealing with the ultra-Orthodox students in order to give them an exemption. The defense minister, Gallant, said, I'm not going to propose a new law unless everybody in this coalition supports it. When they had a meeting to talk about it, Benny Gantz refused to go to the meeting. If there's no law produced, then all of a sudden, 66,000 of these students, right now, there are only like about 500 or 600 that have actually signed up. 66,000 are now eligible to be drafted. And one of the chief rabbis said, well, if that happens, I'm going to tell everybody to leave and go to some other country, at which point a lot of Israelis said, that would be great, because then we wouldn't be paying taxes for them to stick around here and not serve in the army. So you've got a lot of internal pressure on, guess who? Mr. Netanyahu. How that plays out, how that overlaps with what I was talking about in terms of Rafah, we've got a huge set of question marks that are going to extend throughout the entire month of Ramadan.
Everybody, thanks so very much. Really appreciate a terrific conversation. As always, hope you guys have a great weekend, great week. Look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks to all of you for joining us, and a special thanks to all of our sponsors that make this program possible. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. And also check out our award-winning weekly podcasts, Cavas Ships, hosted by our own Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace to clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with Laura Winter, sponsored by TE Connectivity, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space. And the Air Power podcast, sponsored by GE Aerospace, that I co-host with our own JJ Gertler. We'll see you again on Sunday for the Business Roundtable. Until then, have a great day, and we'll see you again soon.